Mr. Monopoly here. Monopoly is back at McDonald's. Register in the McDonald's app so you're ready to...
get your bag!
Two ways to peel for a chance to...
get your bag!
Physical peels with select items and digital peels with others to...
get your bag!
Play Monopoly at McDonald's.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
No purchase necessary. See rules at playatmcd.com for full details and amoe.playatmcd.com to play without purchase. Ends November 23rd, but bonus play ends November 2nd. Monopoly is a registered trademark of Hasbro. Copyright McDonald's.
This is Sunny Bunch. Welcome back to the Bulwark Coast of Hollywood. I'm very pleased to be joined this week by Zach Stentz, who is the writer most recently of Camp Cretaceous, which is a hit Netflix series. I saw it was in the top 10 shows the other day. Very exciting.
And for more than one day, usually you get two or three days on Netflix and then something else comes along.
Yeah, we can talk about that in a second, because I'm fascinated by the creative perspective on the whole Netflix phenomenon. It's there's so much stuff there that it's interesting to kind of hear how it works from your end of things. Zach, I'm really excited to talk to Zach because he's a creative force in Hollywood. He has made some of your favorite movies. When you were looking at making something for Netflix, could you walk me through the process there and kind of how different it might be from other studios or production houses? You had this great thread on Twitter the other day, kind of explaining to normies like myself, like, well, this is what it looks like to actually pitch a show and have it be, accepted. Could you walk us through how that works?
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing about Netflix is that, they're not competing with HBO. They're not competing with NBC. They're not competing with Warner Brothers. They want to be all of it. they are a complete media ecosystem, and they are all about saturating every single demographic, so that there's whatever you are, there is going to be something there for you. So sometimes that means, okay, we want something for kids. We want something for older women. We want something for people who love crime shows. Sometimes that's, we want a big four quadrant hit. And I think in the case of, the last two things I've done have been for Netflix. I did a movie for them a couple of years back with McGee directing, and at the same time I was developing the Camp Cretaceous show for about 3 years for them, and in both cases they wanted something that families could watch together. That was a hot thing for them. And pitching to them is a lot like pitching to the other studios, but with the knowledge that it's changed in the last 3 or 4 years, the stereotype, that everything is changing so fast in Hollywood, that the stereotype used to be that whatever you brought to Netflix, they were going to buy. That is, like you've seen the comedy sketches where, sure, Netflix is like throwing stacks of money at people. Sure. That is very much no longer the case. They're very much aware of their dominant position in the market now, and it's much more, well, what can you bring us that we don't already have, because we already have everything.
Mm-hmm. Well, how do you square that circle then? I mean, when you're putting together a pitch for the network that has everything but wants even more, how do you sweeten the deal for them?
The same way that I do for everyone else. I don't think of pitches with a particular customer in mind. I try and lead with the creative and try and lead with what makes me excited about this, because and then go outward from there. Because frankly, if you can't excite yourself with something, you're not going to excite anyone else. And in both of the cases, in Rim of the World and then with Camp Cretaceous, I wanted to do something that I wanted to bring back an almost dead genre, which is the kids on an adventure together genre. And in this case, Netflix you know, has been kind of rushing into these areas that have kind of died out, that the other studios have stopped doing. You know, for example, the rom-com almost exclusively lives on Netflix and streaming mm-hmm. now. It's very rare, even when theaters were open, to see a rom-com there. But you'll see, you know, but Netflix loves them and the audiences love them. So in this case, my instinct was, you know, the kind of Goonies, E.T., you know, kid, again, kid and teen centric adventure genre that I grew up on and that I really loved has died out by and large. And this felt like a fun opportunity to bring it back. And Netflix seems very aware of that. And they do like reviving, you know, reviving genres that seem moribund.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. You know, I watched Rim of the World, and I really do love it as that kind of Spielbergian throwback, right? Like this, you know, you've got these kids who are trying to make their way through the world and not getting much help from adults. In fact, like it almost felt like you guys went out of the way to kill every adult on screen, except for I think the guy right at the end, the general, which was kind of a, you know, it was amusing, and it definitely made me it reminded me of those like kind of kid empowerment type movies. But it feels like the sort of thing that you couldn't take to a Universal or a, you know, I don't know, MGM or Paramount these days anymore, that they would just look at it and say, well, how are we supposed to spend $50 million on this, you know, yeah. and market it?
Yeah, I think that's very true. And again, let's assume for the sake of argument that theaters are going to come back, but there is a different barrier. There is a different barrier to entry for here's my $10 or my $12 to buy a movie ticket and to get my ass out of the house. And I'm going to click on this tile because it seems interesting. And I think Netflix has figured out that it's a different calculus that goes into whether an audience wants to watch something or not when they make it so easy to click on it.
Yeah, and that the ease of the clickability. I mean, you hinted at this a little bit earlier, just the kind of tendency for something to be in the top 10 for a day or two and then fade away. Is that a fear for you as a creator that you're going to make something and it's going to be, you know, it's going to live on Netflix forever, but people will only really see it for a day or two and then it goes away?
Yeah. I mean, it is a fear in a way that you become this drop in this ocean of content that they have, and that they're not super big into marketing campaigns, that, you know, Netflix's idea of a $30 million ad buy is your tile appears at the top of the screen. Yeah. That, you know, it's very different. And of course, because of the constant churn, you know, very soon you find yourself in the back catalog. But frankly, I don't think that's any different anymore than how it is. I think that's increasingly how people are consuming media. And your job as a creator is to hopefully create something sticky and memorable enough that people will keep finding it and people will keep discovering it. One of my very best friends, for example, wrote a movie that did get released theatrically and got some of the worst review, you know, like just poisonously bad reviews. Mm-hmm. But then people are discovering it on streaming and discovering that they're actually, and the intended audience in particular, which was teens and young adults, are finding it and actually saying, many of them aren't even aware of the reviews that it got when it mm-hmm. was in theaters. And they're like, we really like this. They're like, mm-hmm. like, this is, you know, this is something we really enjoy. So, you know, I like to think that the long tail, as they say, still does exist, even in the age of Netflix.
That's interesting. I often think about this as a critic myself, you know, like, how much use some of these reviews are for the intended audience, because the intended audience, as you say, often is not reading, you know, what the 30-something critic is saying about their, you know, teen rom-com movie. What do they care? It doesn't matter. But then that having everything there on Netflix or HBO Max or wherever, it kind of it creates an avenue of discovery that I think was not really there, you know, even in the age of Blockbuster or Family Video or whatever, right?
I think that's right. And I'm someone who I grew up in a very small town with one movie theater with two screens. And, you know, so the vast majority of even big movies that I ended up seeing when I was a kid and a teenager were, you know, 6 months later when they hit video. And, you know, you'd beg the, I'd beg the, owner of the video store to give me the promotional Temple of Doom poster when they were done with it.
Yeah. That's great. So let's walk through what a pitch for a show is like, because I think, again, this is something that, you know, your average viewer or consumer of media has no experience with. I mean, we all work jobs and we all have had to pitch things to bosses, but I feel like it's very different when you're pitching a TV show or a movie or something. So could you walk us through the stages and what you put into your pitch packages for the execs?
Yeah, every pitch is different, and I will say, and different writers and different creators have very different ways of pitching. In the words of the great sage Owen Wilson, there are many paths to the waterfall, and all I can speak to is my own experience in pitching TV, which is, I will say, is very different from pitching a movie. I pitched a movie right before I was on this call with you, and it was very much, here's the theme at the top, here are other movies that it will remind you of tonally, and then right into, I'm going to tell you the story of the three-act structure. Mm-hmm. When you're pitching a TV show, especially one that you're hoping to go on for seasons and seasons, I tend to focus on the characters more than anything, because at the end of the day, people are mostly watching television for the characters, even more so than the plot. So I generally will start by talking about the main character and the supporting characters. I will give the 30,000 foot view of the story of the show. And then I will focus in on, here in broad strokes is what the first episode looks like. Here in even broader strokes is what the first season looks like. And then here are some notional ideas for what other seasons could look like in case, you know, and I like to say, most of the time you're not going to end up using most or even some of the material from those future seasons. But what you're doing with that notional, with those notional ideas is letting people know this is an idea that's not going to run out of gas after 10 episodes. It's mm-hmm. not, you know, like Prison yeah. Break. What's season 3 of that? you know, like, God bless them. They did figure out, yeah. Let's put them in another
eight
prison.
Seasons. Yeah. Yeah. We'll send them to the Mexican prison. That's, yeah. that's where they're going to be. Yeah.
They managed to do it, but you know, in that pitch, they had to have said, don't worry, this, you know, like once yeah. they get out, the show is not over.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it is interesting to think about, just because, the whole point of TV is that it kind of keeps going, that it's you have multiple seasons, multiple stories to tell. And with a project like Camp Cretaceous, for instance, I mean, it does seem I don't want to spoil anything, but I'm curious, where you go once the action on the island actually ends, right? Like once everything, you know, kind of wraps up with that first movie, then I don't want to spoil anything, but
I am not going to spoil anything, but I will tell you that when I went in and pitched them and gave them the very extensive materials, I had notional ideas for five seasons and how okay. you could make it different and interesting each of those seasons. So I will say with great confidence, That yes, you can. Yes, it is an idea that sustains itself for longer than one season. Honestly, a lot of the problems are simply logistical, which is and I never worked in animation before I did Camp Cretaceous, so it was this huge education for me. But doing especially computer animated animation is a lot more like doing live action than it is like doing hand-drawn animation, because each of the characters in each of the sets or environments is a build in CGI. So it's very much like live action. Like, how can we reuse the same characters? How can we reuse the same sets? How, you know, like we can't just draw a new dinosaur each time we want one, because that's a build. So there's a certain conservation that goes on. You know, it what the spoiler alert, the helicopter that you see in episode 6, we couldn't afford that. That was actually from our sister show, Fast and Furious Spy Racers. They let us use a couple of the models for their vehicles there. So that's interesting. But then a challenge, you know, a challenge with the kids is simply, if hypothetically speaking, you do more than one season, you have the issue of, okay, do you skip forward? And if you skip forward, these kids are supposed to be 14, 15 years old. Do you have to build new models because they've grown? Or do you set it over a more compressed time frame and let them stay the same size? But, you know, God bless them. The animators did a great job with, like, their hair gets more messed up. They get dirtier. They get more than one change of clothes, you know, but that's all art time. And that's all rendering time. Just doing something as simple as that. You see in live action how, you remember the show Lost, how they had to write Walt off the show simply because the show was taking place over the course of days. And right. They cast a freaking teenager, a shrimpy teenager who, you know, was like 6'3" by season three. And, you know, come up with an explanation for how that happened over the course of a month.
Yeah. No, that's something.
Way to think that one out, Damon.
Yeah. You really screwed the pooch on that one. It's interesting. So is there some synergy then? Because these are both Universal properties. Using the models from the Fast and Furious cartoon for the Jurassic World cartoon. I mean, I'm curious how that actually works. Do you just like go to the next door over and be like, hey guys, we need to borrow this real quick?
Yeah, you know, in the case of Jurassic World, you know, like when we sold that show, DreamWorks Animation had a massive output deal with Netflix. I think they were supplying them with like 15 shows or something like that. And each one of them was in different animation styles, but we were very lucky in that one, you know, the Fast and Furious show was the next pod over in the office building that we were at. And they were using a similar enough style of animation that we could share assets a little bit. That isn't necessarily the case if, you know, like, you know, we couldn't use a horse from, you know, the Spirit Stallion of the Cimarron show, because it's a completely different animation style. Whereas we were sharing the, you know, the kind of same aesthetic of the characters are slightly stylized, but the vehicles and the non-human creatures are as realistic as humanly possible for a TV budget.
Yeah, and there's other things to consider here as well with the matching up with the movie. You tweeted out a great clip from YouTube of somebody had synced up the action in the cartoon with the action that was taking place in Jurassic World on that helicopter scene that you mentioned. And it really is interesting because they both work perfectly with each other. I mean, it, having to balance that, you know, real world versus cartoon, whatever is fine, but just tonally and stylistically, they both really match. Is that something, you know, how do you as the creator kind of make that work just on its own? And then it syncs up so well.
Yeah. It honestly, it synced, you know, like the writers on the show and the animators, you know, studied that first Jurassic World movie like it was the Zapruder film, you know, almost frame by frame. And they did, you know, they did a whole chart of like, okay, you know, at this point, the Indominus is here and then the Indominus is here, but this is several hours difference. So within those several hours, maybe it had a cross with our kids. You know, there was the plot aspect, and then there was simply the tonal choice that we all made of yes, there's going to be kid-friendly humor. Yes, there's going to be a dinosaur poop joke, but it will feel as if it could plausibly take place in the same universe as the live action films. And the main way that you do that is frankly simply playing the emotions and playing the stakes is being completely real and actually believing that these kids are in mortal danger at different times. I saw one YouTube review of these two guys watching the show, and they actually shot their own reactions when they episode four, when the kids witness one of the park workers getting eaten by the Indominus, and you know they're recoiling the way the kids are. They're like, oh, we didn't realize this was a show that they were going to go there.
Yeah. Yeah, I one thing I really admire about this and Rim of the World as well is the treatment of the subject matter with the kids, because it feels, I mean, obviously it doesn't feel real in the sense of real, but it feels real in the sense of kids have to see things that are bad sometimes. They have to, you know, experience things that are not great. I feel like you as a creator don't really sugarcoat that.
Yeah. I mean, it's part of my storytelling DNA. I love kid and teen protagonists, partly because their emotional lives are so huge and, you know, they're much more kind of open books in that way. But it goes, you know, I grew up on the great Spielberg films and the great kind of 80s kid adventure films. But even before that, you know, like growing up on fairy tales and, you know, Grimm's folk tales and things like that, horrible things happen in those stories. And the kids are witness to horrible things and they lose their parents and witches want to kill them and all kinds of things happen. And I think those are valuable feelings for kids to feel, because the message of all of those stories tends to be the same, which is the world is a scary place. There are bad things and bad people that can happen, but you can get through it, and you have it in you to get through it if you're smart and empathetic and decent and maybe a little lucky. And that's I think that's a good thing for young viewers to get from their TV and movies.
Yeah. Now, I mean, I don't want to make this a show about controversy, because it's not what the show is about. But you had mentioned something when we were talking about the whole cuties thing that Netflix has been going through. Is there a possibility that filming just in general is inherently kind of exploitative of children? And like, how do we protect them the best way? And one thing you had suggested, I couldn't quite tell if it was tongue in cheek or not at first, but was using adult performers in mocap type situations to actually portray, you know, teenagers. Is that a thing that you could see happening? Were you being tongue in cheek? I mean, I'm curious.
I was being a little tongue in cheek, but I was being tongue in cheek to kind of provoke people to kind of think more deeply about the subject, because it is a fraught subject when there are no easy answers to. As we know, there is a whole history of kids in entertainment, you know, got going back even before the movies and TV, of child performers being exploited in different ways, sexually, emotionally, financially. Right. You know, so it's a fraught and difficult thing. And yet at the same time, I've also met young performers who love what they do, and you know, it's and have wonderful and supportive parents and not stereotypical stage mommies and stage daddies. And it's, to me, it's much more, you know, when it's positive, it's much more of the case of, it's the performing equivalent of a kid who wants to be an Olympic athlete and their parents are taking them to their hours and hours of practice after school every day and driving them to meets and, you know, hours and hours. It's a huge commitment to the whole family, but you also almost have an obligation if your kid has a passion and your kid has something that he or she is very good at to let them pursue that. So I don't think there are easy answers here, but I think it's incumbent on all of us who work in the entertainment industry to be conscious of and to protect the kids who work in the industry a lot better than we are now. And that's not just, you know, like keep them from getting their money, you know, getting their money stolen and keep them from being ripped off. But also just, you know, even in the way you film a kid or a teenager, there are choices that go into that. And there mm-hmm. are exploitative ways and there are non-exploitative ways. But those are all things that should be, you know, but those decisions are ones that should be taken with great thought and great care, because, you know, as adults, that's part of the deal of being an adult, is that you have the responsibility to protect people who aren't yet adults.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it really is an interesting and fraught subject. And I don't want this to be the controversy show. That's not what we're going for here. But it's something to think about. And I think to think about in ways beyond people are thinking about it on Twitter, which has just been, Twitter shockingly is not a great place for nuance.
No, Twitter is a terrible place for nuance, but you know, I'll give you an example. I won't say, you know, cause I've worked on multiple projects that have had kids and teens, but I remember, you know, a director, you know, like shooting a young actor, you know, like shooting a young actress, and we're in Video Village looking at it, and the director said, and it was in a very like non-creepy way, it's like she's so pretty that I have to be very careful about how I shoot her, because it would be very, and you know, you think about, you know, poor Brooke Shields, you know, going sure. all the way back to Pretty Baby and things like that. It's like I have to be very conscious that I'm shooting her in a way that doesn't sexualize her because she's a kid. And yeah. And I was super impressed by that. I was super impressed that the director was actually thinking about those things in choosing how to frame shots and light shots, because that would have been creepy and exploitative to shoot a 13-year-old actress that way.
Yeah. Yeah. Let me shift gears slightly. And I saw you mention something on Twitter today, actually, about the way Disney Plus is running their shows and kind of the, you know, the just some stuff you had heard. And I'm curious, as a creator, what is your kind of preferred writer's room / how you run a show scenario? I mean, I like there are a bunch of different ways you can do it, and I'm always interested to hear what creators prefer.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in the very old. I grew up as a writer in the very old school. There is a showrunner who is an executive producer and is also the head writer, and the show, you know, it's whether it's a Shonda Rhimes or a Greg Berlanti or a Ryan Murphy, the show is kind of a product of their head. And they, you have a staff of writers who sit around in a room together, and their job is to use their own creativity to channel the voice of the show and to figure out how to write to that. We are going, you know, the models in TVs are changing incredibly rapidly. We have now the model where there is no writing staff. It's like British TV, where it's just one person coming in and writing 6 or 8 episodes, and, you know, as if it's a long screenplay, and they're still in charge. And then there's the model that's emerging at places like Disney Plus, especially with their big marquee titles, where they're much more director driven. They're essentially, you know, whereas in the 5 years before, we saw the TV model being exported to features. You had features being written by writers' rooms. Mm-hmm. Now you have the feature model being imported to TV, where you have the reins of the creative process being held by the director and not the head writer, and you know, where the head writer is like third and actually called the head writer and not the showrunner, and the head writer is third behind the director, and in some cases a studio executive sits in the writer's room every mm-hmm. day, which terrifies me. That sounds, you know, when I hear that, it sounds like, you know, like freaking, you know, Soviet Army circa 1942. And you've got the political officers next to you asking why you're retreating.
Yeah. Yeah. That is, that's interesting. It's fascinating because I, like you say, there are just so many, there's so many different ways to do it. As somebody who's worked with Netflix, I've always heard that they are very good, and maybe I'm wrong. Please correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I've always heard that they're very good on showing filmmakers and TV show runners like what is working with the data, like what people are, where people tune out, or where they you know, switch to something else. I'm just curious if they shared any of that with you on Rim of the World or Camp Cretaceous, and like if that helps or hinders the creative process.
I haven't had that happen yet on Camp Cretaceous, although I'm expecting it soon, because they have the standard way of doing. They have the, like, after 10 days, they're like, they open the vault a little and say, this is what our data shows of mm-hmm. what how people are watching, how much people are watching, what percentage of the people are watching all the way through. And then they again at 30 days, they're like, and here's how it's performing after 30 days. And it is, you know, it's interesting and kind of, and it all goes into the, you know, it all goes into your head when you're hopefully doing future seasons or sequels or what have you, but you can't let it, you can't let the data drive the creative process. Mm-hmm. Maybe some people can, I can't work that way. I have to lead with story, and then, okay, do we need something here so people, you know, don't tune out? Yeah, you do think about those things, but hopefully the data is not the tail that's wagging the dog of the story.
Yeah. Well, you know, that was pretty much everything I wanted to ask you. I always like to ask all of my guests if there's anything that they think that people should know. I mean, is there anything that you think people should be aware of about what you do and what the, you know, misconceptions that you want to correct here with an open mic?
I mean, I guess the only misperception that I think that a lot of people have is of working Hollywood as being this very rarefied environment, and you know, it's A-listers going from private yacht to private jet and things like that. And I guess I'd like to say, you know, my actual experience of Hollywood is much more blue collar than that. It's much more, you know, like a film or a TV set is much more like, you know, it's a construction site with snacks, and you know, where people happen to be acting in the middle. And I guess I'd love, you know, I want people to enjoy the product that we do, but I'd love people to have a less kind of rarefied and more realistic view into what goes into making it, which is, you know, a bunch of, you know, middle class to blue collar people doing jobs and trying our best to keep you all entertained.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Zach, very much for being on the show. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I really had a great time. These are great questions.
We will be back next week with another episode of The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood.
At Ability Chiropractic, they do things differently. They believe lasting health starts with understanding how your body truly works, not masking pain with quick fixes. Their doctors take time to educate and empower you to take control of your wellness journey. Through gentle, customized adjustments, they help you restore proper function and unlock your body's natural healing power. That's why Columbus families have trusted Ability Chiropractic since 2012. See the difference for yourself. Book your appointment today at abilitychiro.com.
CODA salutes those who served. Veterans ride free Tuesday, November 11th. And every other day of the year, our veterans and active duty military personnel get a 50% discount on all fares. It's all part of CODA's ongoing commitment to show appreciation for your selfless service. To ride at no cost on fixed routes, tell your bus operator that you're a veteran or use code VET2025 in the app to use CODA Plus. Veterans ride free on Tuesday, November 11th for Veterans Day. Veterans get a 50% discount every day on CODA. Plan your ride and learn more at CODA.com/trip planner.
During the Right Rug Flooring Anniversary Sale, we're celebrating 91 years of the guaranteed lowest prices. With beautiful carpet with a lifetime stain warranty starting at $219 a square foot installed with pad. And luxury vinyl starts at $399 a square foot installed. Unbeatable prices and 24-month special financing available with approved credit. Schedule a free in-home appointment with our flooring experts at RITERUG.com. Right Rug Flooring's Anniversary Sale.